Be unapologetically autistic. Like, those who matter won't mind, and those who mind don't matter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Special Interest Podcast. I'm Alex.
Hey, and I'm Carly. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We're so happy to be back in this space with you all today. We'd love to introduce you to our guest. Today, we are introducing you to Voss. Welcome, Voss.
Hi, thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I'm very excited about being on the pod. Thank you so much. As kind of a little brief about me, in my undergraduate kind of degree, I was kind of before that, I was very much like a kid that related to Matilda, just in terms of being like this weird little girl that had these like crazy powers, and everyone was like, what the fuck are you doing? You know? My mom always has a joke that she tells people that she's like, when, you know, Voss was little, I used to have to come back and check in on her specifically doing like science projects in the backyard because I thought she was going to blow something up. She was like, I don't know if it would be on purpose, but it's a concern. And so that was kind of that. But and from there, I got into Berkeley, went there pretty quickly, got into like substance use. For kind of like a number of reasons, but a big part of it was just that it allowed me to, first of all, be by myself. Like when I was overstimulated, like at a party or a bar, and I wanted to be somewhere quiet, I would be like, hey, I'm gonna go to the bathroom. Like it was like, I'm gonna, you know, separate myself from this stimulation. And I kind of needed an excuse to do that. And so I might as well involve substances. And so my particular issue was mainly with like stimulants. And it to others looked like a very social thing, you know, like I was a very social person and I was using it a lot. And people would just be like, girl, calm down. Like, what is your problem? And as it turns out, the problem was undiagnosed autism. So when I was 25, after like a hospital visit and then kind of a couple months breakdown and then finally agreeing to move back home, like from Chicago. And so now I'm back home and figuring out what I'm doing from here. Sorry, I know that that was probably like a lot.
Thank you so much for sharing. No, in this space, nothing is too much. You are welcome to share whatever, you know, you feel called to and whatever kind of like flows out. That's kind of what Carly and I do. So
awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. So if you don't mind sharing, like, what was the beginning of like your autistic journey like for you? Like, when did it begin? How did it begin?
So in terms of a formal diagnosis, it was, when I was 18 and I had started kind of using specifically cocaine, my doctor was like, oh, we've got to nip this in the bud. You know what I mean? And so he diagnosed me with bipolar disorder, bipolar 2, which still stands. Like that's been pretty confirmed. But he gave me a pretty strong mood stabilizer. I was on lithium for like my first go of mood stabilizers and it worked. You know, like he would ask, like, do you feel more stable? Like, do you feel less emotional? And I was like, yes, but also I kind of feel like I just walk around and then fall asleep with my eyes open. You know what I mean? Like I felt even further than like zombified, like just completely like not present at all. And so there was that. I was on that for years and years. And I used to have really bad withdrawal symptoms anytime I would have it gone for like even a day or so, it would make me like very emotional and I would get really shaky. And that was on top of a tremor that I had like all of the time in my hand when I was on lithium. So my doctor said, you know what? We're just going to cut it off. We're just going to not have you do lithium anymore. And I like spiraled so fast that I got put in an intensive outpatient program, and mid IOP, my boss from work calls me because it was like semi-illegal and calls me and is like, hey, you're fired as of today and your health insurance ends today. And so I literally like couldn't even call my counselor to tell her that I was leaving, because I was like, those are billable calls. Like, I'm not fucking doing this. And so I was like freaking the fuck out. And so that was stressful. I got another job. The next job was, it was really meaningful work for my, clients. I worked with people in the Chicago or in the, Elk Grove Village area in Illinois. And it was, I was in charge of a program that helped people mainly from like the hospital or from having a crisis that they cannot live alone or can't live independently. And what you would do, and they would be kind of living in these apartments and we would check in on them and they would have a counselor and we would, I would kind of give them supports. And the goal was that in 2 years, ideally that they graduate from this program and that they are able to live independently. So I taught them kind of basic emotional skills, and I led group therapy, and I just kind of like had to encourage people sometimes. Like I had my boss was talking to me one day and she mentioned, hey, you have to make sure that client B, who is pretty unstable, goes to his like injection for a psychiatric medication because he's kind of iffy about it, but he's known to kind of like not follow restraining orders when he doesn't take his medication. And so it was my job to just like drive him around and talk to him. And we even went and got boba and he didn't have any money on him. And I was like, don't worry about it. Like, it's a couple dollars. Like, so we sat there and we talked and he was like, you know, I just feel like I need to focus on getting my wife back and get, and I was like, well, like the restraining order still has 2 years, babe. So, and he was like, but she didn't make it longer. And I was like, let's refocus. And so I kind of just talked him into like, you know, in order to get on this long path of getting your life back, you know, the way you want it to be, you have to take these baby steps. Because my boss told me that she was like, if he doesn't take this medication, he also is kicked out of our program because that's medication non-compliance. And as far as what, where he goes after that, it's not really clear. Like, it was just not our job to figure out where people go. And that to me was like so deeply upsetting. But so I had a lot of emotional trauma at that job. I had to deal with clients calling me all of the time being like, I'm being stalked, please help me. And having to discern whether like they were in a psychiatric crisis or like a literal crisis. And like, I don't know, there's not a difference between psychiatric and literal, I would like to stipulate, in that like sometimes people were being stalked or sometimes their boyfriend did come over and there was an issue and they need urgent help. I guess that's more the distinction, is that whether people needed urgent help or whether they needed maybe to like ground themselves and recenter and refocus and use their coping strategies. So there was that. That job was also deeply stressful, and I got fired for the reason that I feel like autists always get fired, or at least a person with autism and ADHD like me gets fired, is because of attendance. Like, I was meeting all of my requirements. I was going to every single meeting. I was doing all of the things that they needed me to, but I would leave early, you know, like I would get there late sometimes. And on top of that, they called me out for using the bathroom frequently when I'm like fucking diabetic. Like, I'm so sorry that like, am I supposed to just piss myself in this seat? You know, like kind of the way that works with diabetes is that when my blood sugar is high, which was happening like multiple times a day at the time, just because I was under so much stress and I couldn't really focus on my diabetes care. And so I would often like run out of insulin at work or like just have a super high blood sugar. And my body just needs to get all of that sugar out really urgently. And so I will have to pee like really frequently. I have to drink a ton of water just in order for my body to like flush out all of that sugar naturally. And so with that, high stress, I got fired from that job again for attendance. And from there, I kind of was like, you know what? This is the universe telling me like, I don't belong in Chicago. Like I should not be here right now. Cause it also like, I was at an age where I could have been on my parents' insurance for nearly free, you know, for only co-pays, which is really nice now that I'm here. But in Chicago, I fully did not have insurance often because jobs would say, well, when you're probationary, like your job, your insurance doesn't start until 90 days and this and that. And that, God, that was the bane of my existence because I would like need psychiatric help and then need a job in order to get that help. But in order to get that job, I needed help. And so I just felt so helpless. And, there was a suicide attempt that I did. Sorry, like trigger warning with that. But there was a suicide attempt. And in the hospital, the nurses didn't really know how to treat me because I was type 1 diabetic and they were psychiatric nurses. And they were like, I don't know, we usually don't have to give people syringes this frequently. There was actually a photo that I took when I got out. Because they, instead of giving me my insulin, I'll kind of visibly show on here, like here in the kind of like meatier part of my arm on the outer side. Because ideally, like places with fat are the best places to put pump sites and insulin shots. But so instead of like here, they put it like all the way up in my armpit. And it was so painful. And I would be like, hey, that really hurt. And they're like, yeah, shots really hurt. And I was like, no, I take shots every day. I'm telling you, this is not right. But so the doctor, when I finally saw her, was like, you know what? I don't think that you need to be here. Like, I don't think you need to be in this psychiatric hospital. I think you just kind of had a crisis and we were able to stabilize you. You've calmed down. But I don't think that there's anybody that we can, like, give you to, you know, like anybody that can pick you up and care for you. Because I was in like a complicated situation with a roommate who had tried to harm my cat and was just like doing crazy shit to me that was like so unreal. And as typically goes with those things, we were in the same friend group and she would to other friends be like so kind and be like, I don't know what's wrong with Voss. Like, I feel so bad for her. And then would like do shit to me. And so my doctor was like, can't go there. I talked to your mom because I had allowed them to talk to my parents. Like I have a really great relationship, especially with my mom in terms of like care and like respecting my wants and needs. And so I okayed them to talk to her and the doctor's like, so your mom is picking you up. I'm like, my mom lives in California. Like, what do you mean my mom? They're like, your mom booked a flight for tomorrow. And so tomorrow morning, you are getting picked up. I was like, my room is not in any state for my mom to be seeing this, you know? Like, I was just not getting out of bed. So there was a ton of, like, food wrappers in the bed. My mom was like, eating in bed? I was like, oh, there's so many better things you could be upset about. But and so with that, I just kind of like my mom was very caring, but pretty insistent that she wanted me to come back to California. and ready to like move me back to California. But at the time I was like, no. But after I got fired from this most recent job that I had, where I was in charge of that program, I was like, you know what? This is the universe telling me that I just don't belong here. So my mom, we like packed up the essentials of my belongings in my car. And we were gonna have more space, but my there was just not an account for my cat, Biscuit. And I was like, no. Like, I was like, I will get rid of anything I need to in order to bring him. And so we talked about it and we figured out we can like put a litter box against like some luggage in a car and keep it like stable and kind of stationed there. Biscuit was happy as a clam. He's usually kind of like a bitch about stuff. He like is kind of aggressive, on the more aggressive side of a normal cat. And it was difficult for him to get along with my other roommate's cat just because she was on like a very passive side. And so he would chase her around and be a dick. And it was like, no, please stop. She's not interested. But now he is an outdoor, indoor cat because there's a lot of them in my neighborhood. And it's a very cat safe neighborhood. And he just loves fucking around out there. And so with that, we moved back. Immediately the doctor is like, yeah, I think you need like an autism like assessment. And so I go to one assessment, and then I go to another assessment, and then I go to one, and this is the one that's going to be like 4 hours long, and it's like they like show you stuff and they ask you about things, or they show you things and like test your memory and like test your ability to like find patterns and stuff like that. And the difficulty with me being diagnosed was that autism was viewed as somebody who had like an intellectual disability, and I didn't. Like, I had gotten into UC Berkeley, and so that was what was really perplexing and not allowing me to get care, was that doctors were like, like, she's a very smart girl and she does drugs, and so I think, you know. But so after going to rehab like 1.5 times, years prior, I had gotten an ADHD diagnosis at 21 mid rehab. And then at 25, the doctor was finally like, yeah, no, this is kind of a crazy case, but somehow you have managed to be undiagnosed with autism for 25 years. But you are autistic. You know, it was just a call. And it felt so funny to me because it felt almost as if, like, I was waiting on, like, application or something. Because he was supposed to call me at, like, a certain time. So I'm just, like, sitting there. And it feels almost like, no, it feels more like when people are sitting on stage at, like, Maury. You know, like Maury Povich, and they're just like, all right, let's go. And so I pick up the phone, and I knew that I had autism. Like, it was pretty clear by this point. And he had communicated that he was like, yeah, your autism test is pretty high, you know? And so I was diagnosed, and then I was kind of like not really given any resources afterwards, was the weird thing. They were kind of given like, oh, you can reach out to ABCD, but the difficulty with services for autistic people is like, as a 25-year-old, like, what do I do after diagnosis? Like, they told me about a group that is for parents of autistic children, but first of all, I always have fears of those that they are ABA oriented, that they're like, you know, kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like conversion therapy-esque for autistic people, or blaming their individual child for their behaviors instead of, you know, understanding from their perspective what is kind of the conflict. And that just didn't seem like it was going to be a supportive space for me. And I just couldn't really find that many resources for autistic adults, especially autistic adults that have like level one autism was my specific diagnosis. Because it's kind of more niche services that I needed, like with harm reduction, as opposed to being put into abstinence only in 12-step rehab. And I'm sorry, what was I talking about? Oh, right. My diagnosis.
Sorry.
Yes. And so kind of I need more specific services, like with therapy. It was difficult for me to kind of connect with a therapist and communicate what my problems were. You know, like I'd be like in tears and they were like, well, what's wrong? What's making you kind of upset about this topic, or what are your feelings? And I was like, I don't know. It just makes my stomach not feel good. You know, like I was kind of just listening to how my body like physically and emotionally felt, but I could not piece together like where it was coming from. And even when I could piece together when it was coming from, like where it was coming from, like kind of progressively through like personal growth and stuff like that, I couldn't stop some of these behaviors, you know, like that was kind of the compulsion aspect of autism that some people face, I feel like. But my compulsion was using cocaine. And you know, there's such a stigma around substance use that it was like I was put into this program that was deeply inappropriate for like my situation. And it was absolutely like, if you look at the troubled teen industry, but if you made it like for adults and more dehumanizing, like there was a dress code, right, for rehab that was like only for this program. And they put it in the program like handbook or whatever. And that day I was wearing short shorts and they were very short, right? And I will acknowledge that, but it was also like upwards of 100 degrees. And I was already having issues with like being incredibly sweaty. So I'm trying to like mitigate that by like wearing less clothes. And they're like, no, you're being, they said, I look distracting. I was like, then be distracted, bitch. Like, I don't care. But the next day, because I took a picture of the dress code just so that I could make sure that my outfit was like in line with all of the things that they asked for. And I show up in a dress and I felt good in it. And then they pulled me aside and they were like, hey, we asked you to follow the dress code yesterday. Like, this is the second time we're having to talk to you about this. So I got told that I was defiant and that I was a bad behaving kid. And that like, I was not serious enough about my recovery. And they were like, you don't want it bad enough. Sorry, one sec. I forgot where I was going with that. Oh, but it was just like really inappropriate caring that they were mean to me. Like they literally. So after that second time when they called me out for a dress code violation that was literally not like in the code, because they were like, oh, well, you're wearing a dress that exposes a lot of your back. I was like, sorry, can you show me on this where it says that I can't show my back? Like, that's so fucking weird. And they said it was an implied rule. Like, goddamn, you know? Like, was so irked by that. And I brought it up for the next like week of treatment. I would raise my hand and I would go, hi, so I'm just wondering if there are any more implied rules, because I would really just like to be informed about them. And it was like partially serious, but partially like, excuse me, ma'am, eat a dick type stuff. Like, I hated the program. We all had to write these goodbye letters to our substance of choice. And I was like, oh, that sounds like it might be like a really therapeutic, helpful project. And they go, but you are not allowed to mention using, you are not allowed to mention your substance of choice or imply anything whatsoever about it. You are not allowed to swear. and you're not allowed to be like inappropriate, like keep it PG-13. I was like, sorry, so I'm supposed to keep like being fried off my ass into like a PG-13 appropriate? So I had no clue how to finish that. But I did it like the day of, and they were like, this is so beautiful. Can we keep it for like other people that are gonna go to recovery here? And I was like, yeah, like as long as I get to graduate, like if you sign my fucking certificate, like we're good, you know? But once I got out, when I went to 12-step services, the thing that made me feel the weirdest was that men acted very kind to me, right? And they were very physical with me after meetings. And keep in mind, it's still in the Central Valley of California and hot as fuck. So sometimes I wear a dress or I don't wear bras all of the time because I'm like, I'm already sweating my tits off. Like, leave me alone. But so things would happen like that. And all of a sudden, I started to notice that guys were, like, very touchy with me, like, in groups. Like, a group of guys would all come up and hug me from the front really hard when I was, like, not wearing a bra and stuff like that. And finally, this woman, after a meeting, walked up to me and she was like, hey, I would be careful if I was you. And she, like, said it in kind of, like, a concerned for me tone. And I just kind of realized that I was like, oh. All of these guys are trying to fuck me. Like, that's not appropriate. Like, that's not, it's exploitative explicitly. Like, anytime I would meet up with somebody from group, like, they would very often be touchy with me and be like, oh, you want to come over? And like, can we share a cigarette and this and that? And I just had to like cut all of those people off, you know, like, regardless of whether they had good intentions or not, I had to assume that everybody didn't. And the last straw for me in 12-step, the last goddamn straw was, I was in a meeting and they asked, like, is there anybody in their first 30 days? And I had like relapsed, I guess, in the sense I hadn't really moved back in my recovery, but I had gone to, I think it was Pride in San Francisco. And I was like, it is my right as a queer non-binary person to get drunk in San Francisco. You know, like, I was like, you can't take that away from me. Sobriety can't take that away from me. And so I was having some drinks, and that set me back in my recovery, I guess, in the game that they have you play, like a chutes and ladders type, you know. And so I raised my hand because I was in my first 30 days. And this was not my typical meeting. So I was like introducing myself to all of the people there. And the woman asked me, like, do you need any women's numbers to be like supportive? And that, like, they always ask that just so that they're like, if you feel like you might need to call somebody to help you with your sobriety, or if you have questions or need to talk something out, here are a list of women that are like comfortable reaching out to you. And the reason they do women and men specifically is because they're like, so many goddamn men in this room would call a woman with their dick out, you know, like, so many of them were goddamn. And it wasn't like because they were addicted to things, it wasn't because of an addiction identity, it was just like because they felt supported, you know, like they felt like there were no consequences to them, like 13th stepping or like taking advantage of people earlier in their sobriety and using their privilege as being later in sobriety to like sexually exploit people. But so the last thing they asked, any women's numbers? I said, no, thank you. I have plenty, you know, because this wasn't my home group and my home group had plenty of numbers. And this man stands up, like looks me up and down. And then like gets really close to my face and is like, I could give you some men's numbers. And honestly, I'm not a violent person. But when I say, I was like, I wanted to use every bone in my body to smack the shit out of that man. But what I did because I gave it a moment where I was just kind of like processing of like, oh my God, okay, what are we gonna do? That was literally like directly disrespectful to me and humiliating. And I was the youngest person in that room by probably 20 to 30 years. And so I was just like, I need to get out. And so I got my bag and I put it on my shoulder and I walked the fuck. And it felt good, honestly. And it was really the only way that I was not going to hit this man. And so it was a win-win. But yeah, and that was kind of how I realized that 12-step was not for me. Was there was a big culture around masculinity and like dating people in sobriety and marrying people in sobriety, and everyone had like a rehab boyfriend. And meanwhile, I was in the cigarette smokers area across the street that they made us go to at like the very back of a big parking lot. I chatted up with a lot of people there because there was like three or four of us that were like smokers. And so anytime we would be on break, everyone else would be like getting water and chit chatting. And I would be like, hey, are we going? You know, like, let's head out. And so just with that, 12-step was not for me. And so I was like, but I'm still having issues with both frequent use, like kind of substance misuse, in that I was using drugs like cocaine every day and I had to, in order to kind of like stop this big withdrawal that happened anytime I stopped using. And so I had to keep doing it and keep doing it. And finally it was affecting me in certain like consequential ways. I definitely like very luckily did not have legal issues and stuff like that. And that was a privilege, you know, like I had many friends that did not have that type of privilege and have now like either like faced incarceration or like passed away or been in like unsafe relationships or situations. And that breaks my heart. And that really is what makes me passionate for doing harm reduction work, both in my own life and being kind to myself and saying, for example, if I know that I'm going to get too drunk, if I go to a bar on Tuesday with friends, say, as an example, like maybe not even quitting drinking, but just not going that Tuesday night, you know, and like kind of working the problem backwards. And instead of being like, all right, we're going to cut this the fuck off. Like, it's more like kind of like slowly pruning a tree and being like, you know, sometimes I drink and it's fun and enjoyable, but it's not fun and enjoyable when, for example, like a boundary of mine is that I don't drink really at all, but especially when I'm sad, like I don't sad drink, you know. When I do, it's like with friends, usually once every couple months, just because with type 1 diabetes, like alcohol makes me feel funny and I end up getting like sleepy drunk after maybe like 2 to 3 shots. Fell asleep at my own birthday party by like 10 p.m. because my friends were like, we're on the way, but they were like on the way. But they pulled up, and by the time they pulled up, I was probably 4 or 5 shots deep because I was like, oh, they're on the way, I better like start drinking. And then I got really and by the time they got there, I was like, hey guys, I was like, what's good? My hat's on backwards. Like, you know, we're running around the house with glow sticks. It's okay. We're good. It's great. And maybe like 30 minutes later, I was out cold in bed and all my friends were standing around me being like, boss, wake up, boss, it's your birthday party. And I kept being like, just give me 5 minutes. And then I would just go back to sleep. I had no recollection of saying any of those things. But drugs and alcohol, or like, I guess substances in general, I think it's about knowing yourself and about like knowing the place and time for those type of things. And specifically addressing like negative issues that you have with that substance. Like if you say, you know, whenever I smoke weed, I get really paranoid and I throw up or something like that. Like really stopping yourself and being like, hey, we don't have to stop everything. Like we don't have to completely halt our life and go to rehab. But what if we just don't do that? or if we just look up online, like if there's like a over-the-counter medication that helps with nausea, like anything that they can do, but just to like separate, you know, like the specific aspects that are causing those negative consequences in your life. But anyway, that's kind of the gist. I think I just went on very long chat, but that's the gist of my kind of journey to an autism diagnosis.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. It's a very real thing that I think a lot of people go through. And so we really just appreciate your vulnerability and openness to discuss those topics. I'm sure it's not an easy thing to do, so I just want to recognize that. And a question that kind of just came to mind is, for others that might relate to this experience, how would you suggest that those that are kind of riding the wave with them, like how can we best support people that are going through what you're going through, and also like where you recognize that certain things don't work and haven't worked for you?
Mm-hmm. I think that something that has always been helpful for me is having when I was dabbling with kind of quitting a substance that I really used frequently and cared a lot about, often it felt like a safety blanket that I like needed with me, because if I was going somewhere, if I was meeting friends, I was like, oh, I don't want to start getting weird and like start getting anxious and not have it. And so I had like anxiety about the anxiety. But what was helpful was having somebody that I trusted with me that either A, would politely ask me, like if I was doing something that I had told them, do not let me do this, or like at least question me if I try to do this sort of thing, can stop them and be like, hey, is this a decision that you feel good about? If they're sober enough, if they're, you know, like pretty intoxicated, I think it's usually reasonable to just kind of make decisions for their health that are in their best interest. So even if that means, I've had friends before, like I would have a glass of wine and I would go to the bathroom because I am diabetic and have to pee all the time when I drink. And I would come back and there would be a glass of water. And I was like, didn't I have a drink here? And they were like, oh, just have this water, babe. Just have this. So I think first and foremost, water solves so many situations in terms of interacting with like people who are facing consequences, short-term or long-term, of taking a substance. So that's usually pretty helpful. I think that I used to train people on how to use Narcan, like the opioid overdose reversal medication. I predominantly showed them how, or taught people how to use it intranasally, like with the nasal spray. But there's also like intramuscular types. And so you can have like syringes around if that's what you have or is more comfortable. It's typically cheaper. I was at Target yesterday and I saw this like little ad for like Narcan. And I saw a couple of them next to it. And I was like, fuck yeah, good for them. And I look and they were $50 each. I was like, so if we're going to draw a Venn diagram, you know, of people that would spend $50 on this and people who are around or frequently use themselves opioids, like, it's not really that, there's not really that many people that this is going to be helpful for. So having Narcan is always helpful, just because you never think you need it until something occurs, and a person cannot like administer Narcan to themselves, just because it kind of, it is appropriate only when they are like unconscious and unresponsive. If they're kind of nodding off, like that's typically just what opiates do. Like it's helpful to maybe sit with people or like babysit, in the sense of just like being physically next to them, so that people who will exploit really drunk people or do odd stuff to your friends, like just so that they feel a little bit more like buffed away from that sort of thing, I guess, in a party sense. So I think that's supportive. I think that having harm reduction supplies like fentanyl test strips, super helpful. There's a ton of, I think, distribution for fentanyl test strips like online. I think that like policy wise, there needs to be more advocacy for making it more accessible. Like, I think anybody in the country who is an adult and uses substances should be allowed to have these like safe, you know, products. I think when it comes to minors, that's a whole separate topic because it's complicated in terms of when people are still figuring out how to make decisions for themselves and figuring out their own values. Like even in late teens, you know, but things like even simple things, when I would be at places where I knew people were going to be using, for example, like, intranasal substances, like, snorting, you know, whatever the fuck, I would often take just like disposable straws and I would just cut them in three. Cause that's usually about the length that somebody needs in order to, like snort a substance, and just handing it or just like having a little bowl of them or handing them out to people because that's the safest way to do it. And people will sometimes use dollar bills. I read a study in, I think, Philadelphia that showed that of all of the dollar bills that they like swabbed and surveyed, 100% of $1 bills had fecal matter on them, like some traces of like literal feces. And so that's an issue with using dollar bills. If they're like crisper ones or like kind of higher denominations, that's more advisable if that's all you've got. But those little straws for individuals were best because you can also catch like bloodborne illnesses if somebody like bleeds on like a shared straw or shared substance. And there are plenty of things that you can get like through saliva or nasal, you know, whatever. There would be times when I would be passed a dollar bill and I would look at it and it would be like blood soaked on the top. I was like, I cannot. Like, you know, like that's just kind of a whole separate host of risks that I think would stress me out. But anyway, with being supportive, I think gentle reminders of somebody's goals and aims are helpful, like taking them out of maybe a tense situation or a situation where everyone is doing this thing that they don't like and that they are staring at it and it looks like they really want it. Even being like, hey, want to go outside and smoke a cigarette or get some air? Like, even if it's something that has to be like kind of a compromise and that like cigarettes aren't great, but they're going to be better for you than, you know, whatever it is here. I think that's always helpful, like taking people out of situations that, you know, they're going to be triggered in, of course, politely. And of course, kind of privately is best. When people get called out like publicly, like that's when I would get really defensive and embarrassed. Is because I felt like I was like, oh, okay, so I'm not like everybody else. Like I do too much, or I like don't know when to stop. And that would just like make me feel very embarrassed. But when friends would privately be like, no, we're actually gonna have you get some water, babe, or like, when's the last time you ate? Let's get you a snack. Like, I loved being that person for people, even when I was using substances with them, is like I would have a friend mention to me while we were using that they were like, oh, well, I haven't eaten in, you know, a certain amount of time because I've been so wired on this. And I felt like it was really important to me to not be judgmental because I've been there, right? Like I've been, you know, wanting to be on a bender, but just being like, hey, why don't we just get some nice little snacks? You know, even if it's just like the blandest thing you can imagine, like saltines and water, and being like, let's just get something in your stomach, because that makes people at an increased risk of a overdose is when they don't really have anything to like soak it up or like give them any kind of energy. So I think that getting like a good base layer is typically very good if it's going to be a night that's like a big night out.
Another thing in terms of like letting someone else hold my last little bit of a substance so that I say I have it with me in case there's an emergency. And that friend very often like either A, throws it away, or like B, like just never gives it to me. But it makes me feel more comfortable to know that it was like there. Or even if somebody like lied to me and was like, yeah, yeah, I got it, don't worry, babe. And really like just helped me and encouraged me to take this step off of, you know, this issue that I've been having and have, and take a baby step towards progress. I think another thing is that acknowledging that progress is nonlinear, and that people are like very rarely receptive to people being mean to them because of like a substance abuse issue. Like most people that I met in recovery did not like develop a substance use issue out of nowhere, you know? And I think that I have seen really great models of kind of a middle ground of care between like the medical model of like, you know, they don't have a choice, but it's just a rewiring of their brain. Like there are parts of that that are very true. Like there's biological evidence that supports that type of thing, but there's also a social aspect to it that is people feel disconnected, you know, when they start substance use, whether that be because there's something that eating at them anxiety wise, or if they have trauma, or if they're in a tense situation. But there's not a single person I met that was just like, yeah, it seemed fun, I was a happy kid, but now I'm sad because drugs. You know, it very often was like, well, my marriage was going poorly and I was just really stressed about it. And so seeing people for who they are, as opposed to like, all right, I'm going to do another thing where I threaten this guy that he might go back to prison again. Cause I like the program I was part of, some of the people there were there by court order for whatever reason. So sometimes they would be threatened with like, oh, okay, well now I'm going to bring like a roll, like underwear and a suit for prison. Like somebody brought one to one of the counselors and he was like, oh, I'm going to bring these out for dramatic effect. Like when I'm dealing with people that I'm like, you want to go back to prison? I was like, this is unreal. But anyway, just being supportive, listening to the individual and not necessarily making assumptions, pointing out when they are sober bits and pieces of like, hey, I've noticed that when you take A, B, and C that you are unconscious. And so maybe let's work towards, and being communicative about an individual situation.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. I think, you know, I've kind of like observed there's like such an overlap of people who are neurodivergent and people who have struggled with substance abuse, and all this information is so important, but because of our society, like it's either gatekept or like not okay to talk about. And it's just, it's so important to that people know all of this information and almost like see their story in somebody else, because, you know, I feel like substance abuse can be so lonely.
Yes.
And so I'm just wondering, like, what advice or like what words would you have for somebody who is struggling with substance abuse or their recovery, and maybe they just found out they're autistic or they think they're autistic? What advice might you give?
I would probably say that the first step kind of in that progress is really just processing, like, what is it about this substance that either A, like does something for me that I feel that I need, that I am now using problematically, chaotically, compulsively, et cetera. Like I'm using in a way that impacts me. So pinpointing that issue, like maybe somebody's biggest problem is that their throat really hurts after they smoke cigarettes. So there's that. And then just kind of looking at how you can step back from those specific pieces. And even if, you know, you use one day, like, even if you just like make a line a little smaller or like take a little less or like stay with a friend so that they aren't using a substance alone and risking an overdose, like all of those things are so meaningful in the big picture of recovery.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. And then we have some questions for like a wrap up, I guess.
Okay.
So one of the questions we ask is, what's your autistic glimmer? Like, glimmer is the opposite of a trigger. So what's something that kind of like you see it or hear it or whatever, and it just immediately fills you with joy?
I love pugs. I think they're so cute. And I actually, like, when I see them, I have to, like, remember to focus on what I'm doing, because I'm like, look at the little face with them. And I know that they, like, are bred to not really like live very well, but I'm like, I love them so much. I wanted to get a diabetic alert dog, but I wanted a pug. And my mom was like, so those dogs are supposed to sniff, and this dog can't sniff itself. So, you know, I was like, it's not gonna work out. But I love them from afar.
They are so, so cute. I love pugs too.
Mm-hmm.
And their little tails. Oh my gosh.
Yes. My cat Biscuit. I love when he like just comes on my lap and walks over, because he's so nonchalant about it. Like, he'll just like walk up as if he's like, oh, I've just decided to stop here. That's so crazy. Oh my gosh. My head is, you know, I'm like, that's okay. I'll give you pets.
I love that so much. That kind of brings me to another question. Just to give you like a couple minutes of space, if you wanted to answer our most important question of like, what is one of your special interests? Of course, it could be tied in with what you just spoke about as well, but I'd really love to hear, yeah, what your special interest is.
I really enjoy reading just generally like nonfiction sociological books. Sometimes like big fancy theory books, I probably have to read those more frequently or like more often, because I'll read a paragraph and then I'll just think to myself, like, what the fuck did I just read? But I really love reading like theory as well as books that are about like racism in America, sexism, like queer concepts, and especially their treatment like historically, but more specifically in the United States, just in terms of that's what I've seen and experienced and like in watching. And so that I'm really passionate about. I also have just really gotten into like pins and thrift shopping, and I'm trying to make a wall of weird art. Right now I have a squirrel that was just like in a thrift shop. Like, it was just this like framed photo of a random squirrel. And I was like, he's mine. And, I also have a photo that looks like a collage. It's like framed of Chris Rock, except there's just like a set of pancakes for his legs and there's butter where his penis should be. And he's completely naked. And I'm like, I found that one in a dumpster in Chicago. And when I had to limit all of my stuff to the essentials, I was like, he's essential. I was like, he's gotta come with.
And I just learned recently that Chris Rock is also autistic. I just like Googled it because I was like, I heard this right, right?
That's excellent. I love that. I really have been enjoying watching comedy recently. Like getting into like not really like top, like, you know, like, oh, my wife type artists, but I've loved Daniel Sloss recently. Like, his comedy I think is very powerful in terms of disability and things like that. I enjoy comedy that is brutally kind, you know, that is from a perspective of somebody who has experienced or witnessed, you know, a marginalization and is willing to talk about their experience and punch up. And I like that.
Yeah. Comedy can be so healing.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for everything that you've shared. It's been awesome to learn from you, and, you know, all the information you shared was so important, and your story is so important, and for other people to hear your experiences, you know, our experiences bring us together. So we appreciate you so much, and we're so grateful that we get to share this time together.
Yes, thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking with y'all.
Yeah, and then I guess, like, if you had any anything else you wanted to say to our community or any parting words?
Yeah, I would probably say, like, always carry Narcan, know how to use it. It's crucially important with the fentanyl crisis. And also, like, be unapologetically autistic. Like, those who matter won't mind, and those who mind don't matter, you know? Like, if somebody's going to be rude to me about me playing with my little fidget, like, get out of my house.
Why are you in my house in the first place?
I'm like, I've been bamboozled.
Well, this anyway. Is so fun. Thank you so much, Voss.
Thank you. It's been nice being here.
Yeah, and thanks to everybody for listening. We love you all, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.